Okay, here we go. Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is Direct Impact, and this is what we're going to be talking about.
We must end the war in Ukraine and not escalate it further and further. This is madness.
Madness. Madness. That's what Austria's defense minister is calling the permissible bombing of Russia by the U.S., Germany, and France. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's do it. Okay, so here's what's going on. Some U.S. and NATO countries are playing a very dangerous game of chicken right now with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Presidents Biden and Macron have been especially adamant about this thing, right? Some would argue mad about this thing in their decision to give Ukraine missiles to fire into Russia. Here's the point. You want to make a nuclear superpower angry? Tell him you're going to be attacking his people with missiles and just see what happens. Let's see what happens. This happens. Putin is now saying, essentially, okay, you're going to attack my country? Well, two can play at that game.
In the end, if we see that these countries become involved in a war against us, what they are doing makes them directly involved in a war against the Russian Federation, we reserve the right to act the same way. Overall, it leads to some serious problems.
We reserve the right to act the same way. Did you hear that? Look, there's a lot more to talk about when it comes to President Putin's warning, and I'm going to bring you that in just a moment. But first, I want to show you something else. NATO reaction from those who angrily disagree with their peers, angrily disagree with the United States, the French, and the German decisions to allow the bombing of Russia. I'm going to start with the Austrian defense minister. Her name is Claudia Tanner, saying the West has crossed a red line. That's her. Here's another one. This is a U.S. politician. This is Vivek Ramaswamy, who we all got to know during the Republican debates. He's on Twitter calling Biden and others who want to do this lunatics. He says these lunatics are starting to sound like they want a full-on offense on Russia. He's right. And here's German left-wing icon Sarah Wagner. She says Western leaders are playing with fire for wanting to allow their missiles to attack Russia. Let's hear it.
At some point, there will be a point where something happens. And what happens then is so terrible that you don't want to imagine it. And that's why we can only appeal to everyone who bears responsibility in our country and in other Western countries to stop playing with fire.
Stop playing with fire, she says. Meanwhile, I decided to go to Havana this weekend to do some independent reporting. What I found there was a lot of agreement with Mr. Putin's position, which seems to be sensible, no? Cuba, just 90 miles from the U.S., has long had a friendly relationship with Moscow, and it may be the most perfect place for Putin to make his point about the fact that two can play this game of missile firing, right? And lo and behold, look what's showing up in Havana. See that right there? That's a nuclear-powered submarine, Kazam, it's called. I think it's Kazem. I'm not sure about the pronunciation. Seen here in images at sea, as well as the frigate Admiral Gorshkov, these two vessels, two of four, by the way, are arriving in Havana in the next couple of days. None are carrying nuclear weapons, thank God, but they are planning on conducting military exercises in the Caribbean in what certainly seems to be a message that's being sent by the Russian president along with his Cuban allies. Now, to be fair, I reached out to Cuban officials, and they told me that this is no big deal, don't overreport it. Russian ships have always been going to Cuba. They've been doing so for decades. But, and that's what he says, given the geopolitics of the moment, it's hard to avoid the optics, no? Which are worrying a lot of people around the globe regarding what this could lead to. My God. Are we approaching another missile crisis as occurred in the 1960s between the U.S. and back then the Soviet Union? I mean, Manila, what do you make of this?
Well, Rick, I mean, we can call this the Cuban Missile Crisis 2.0. Mm-hmm. But the problem is we have Joe Biden as president, and he is certainly no JFK. But the Russians are right, I would say, to play this game of muscle flexing because, look, this is in response to U.S. meddling. I am thankful that this is all that they're doing. Let's be clear. The U.S. isn't flexing in Russia's orbit. It's beyond posturing at this point. What the U.S. and collective West is doing is flat out seen as a physical threat to Russia. It's an existential threat to their national security. Bringing NATO weapons along their Western border and creating these hostile relations with their neighbors not only creates an impediment to economic progress, but poses a physical threat to Russia's sovereignty. But here's the difference, Rick. The Cuban missile crisis back then was fraught with, I would say, far more risk than it poses today. Thanks to modern technology, intelligence, there's less worry that the Kazam sub will be subject to any sort of misunderstanding or missteps with the world above water, like that sub in the 1960s. Of course, the U.S. is going to spin this into some sort of escalation. The fact of the matter is, Russian relations with the island have always been good.
Yeah.
And just this past year, Rick, 100 Russian companies have launched business operations in Cuba. So kind of par for the course.
I agree with you. I think if your point is that this seems to be more show than go, I think you're right. I think there's a lot of show here, though. And at what point does a guy like Vladimir Putin turn the show into a go? And I know people on both sides who are looking at this, and they're worried, and they should be worried. I mean, this is getting to the point where a couple of wrong moves or wrong decisions can take us to a point, existentially speaking, once again, where we don't want to be. By the way, meanwhile, there's something I couldn't help but notice as I was reading through news briefs just this weekend. And it's got me thinking about the elections in India. Remember we were talking about the elections in India last week? And it's this question. Why does it seem to me like the West is suddenly celebrating Prime Minister Modi's electoral defeat? I mean, I know he didn't lose because he still, but it was kind of a defeat, right? First, here's a somewhat humbled Modi giving his acceptance speech. After all, he won just not by as much as he was supposed to win by. So let's listen.
I, Narendra Damodaras Modi, swear in the name of God that I will bear true faith and allegiance to India's constitution as established by law.
So I and a few others have been perusing the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Economist, the Financial Times, Le Monde, Deutsche Welle, the Wall Street Journal, France 24, BBC, others, Western, you know, media giants. And it's hard to not notice that there seems to be an orchestrated campaign against Modi all of a sudden in his reelection. Attacks have also come from the U.S. International Commission on Religious Freedoms, VDEM, and Sweden, the George Soros Foundation, interestingly enough, and the U.S. State Department. Duh. Why? Let's see. On Gaza, right, Manila? Modi has continued to support a two-state solution and has sided with the UN General Assembly against Israel. Now, that's not what Washington wants, right? And in Ukraine, India has continually remained neutral, if anything, maybe slightly a little more siding with Russia, while also buying its gas and, you know, other energy products. That is especially not what Washington wants. The funny thing about this story, and the reason I wanted to bring it to your attention, is how parallel what the Western media coverage is to exactly what the State Department seems to be saying and demanding. Funny how that works.
What a coincidence, Rick. So, Rick, I mean, as we discussed last week, Modi and the BJP, they still won. A win is a win is a win. Yeah. They just didn't win bigly, as Trump would say. If you win the Super Bowl by just a field goal, you still win the Super Bowl.
No, yeah.
But the U.S. mainstream media spin machine, as we know, is simply an extension of the state. It's access journalism. In effect, it is state-sponsored media laundered through private sector interest.
Yes.
Mainstream media is mostly, at this point, stenographers for the U.S. government. And India that's led by Modi ensures some level of stability in the global south. Remember, the I in BRICS is India.
Yeah.
Of course, he wants to keep his country fair and neutral when it comes to Russia, Ukraine. It's in the interest of his country to maintain a balanced approach regarding the R in BRICS, that makes sense. And Modi's position on Gaza reflects basically 90% of the world, whether those countries are represented in the UN or not. But even those repped in the UN, like the US, those appointed representatives aren't even speaking honestly for the feeling that the American people have. Most Americans are not on board with this ongoing assault on Gaza. India, at least, is speaking as a true representative of what their constituents are actually feeling.
That's such a great point that you make. It's just a fantastic point that you make about them actually being state TV. Because it seems in my lifetime, after having worked at all of the networks, from Fox to CNN to NBC, et cetera, even Univision, that it's gotten worse and worse. More and more, I see them parroting exactly what it is that the administration or the government or the State Department or the CIA wants them to say. And how sad, right? Because, and I'm not, that's not, that doesn't mean the State Department is always wrong. State Department does a lot of good things, but they shouldn't be in the business of running what Anderson Cooper says every night, because then we're not getting any information. And how in the hell can those people say, we, for example, are state TV, or some other entities are state TV, when they're a better example of state TV than anybody in the world right now? There you go. I said what I wanted to say, and I'm glad I did, and I'm glad you agreed with me on it. Thanks, Vanilla. We'll talk to you again in a little bit.
You got it.
When we come back, he's one of the country's most outspoken advocates for human rights and has served as the counsel for Bosnia and Herzegovina. Did I say that right? Herzegovina. We will speak, I should say, with University of Illinois professor Francis Anthony Boyle, who says there is a direct tie, by the way, between the NATO actions that we're seeing now, historically, and the war in Ukraine. Don't go away. He's good. We'll be right back.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns. Here, we discuss some real news.
Okay, welcome back. Let's continue this conversation. I'm Rick Sanchez. The noted professor of international law counsel, Francis Anthony Boyle, recently said that the conflict in Ukraine can be directly tied to essentially what became, intentional or not, a lie once expressed by Secretary of State James Baker during the first Bush administration. Professor Boyle joins us now to take us through how we got to the place where we are now. Professor, thanks so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you very much for having me on, Rick, and my best to your audience.
Thank you. Take us through that. You say it was all about Baker and what he said that turned out to be a lie. Why and what?
Right. Well, Rick, Secretary of State Jim Baker under Bush Sr. made a promise to Soviet Premier Gorbachev that if he agreed to the unification of Germany, that the NATO alliance would not expand one inch to the east. And on that agreement, Gorbachev went along with the reunification of Germany. Now, let me point out two points. One, some scholars have contested the Baker promise, but the National Security Archives has a comprehensive study you can look at of the promise given not only by Baker, but by other European foreign ministers and prime ministers to the Soviet government at that time. Number two, under international law, oral agreements are binding as a matter of international law, provided they are made by high-level government officials acting within the scope of their authority, which Secretary Baker did. Now, President Bush Sr. Seemed to honor that promise, but when President Clinton came to power, he immediately proceeded to violate it by expanding NATO to the east. And that then brings us up to the U.S.-sponsored coup d'etat against the democratically elected government of Ukraine.
But put that together for us. A lot of people in our audience are saying, okay, how'd you get to Ukraine from there? Draw the roadmap for us for how it is that one day Baker says to Gorbachev, who I interviewed, by the way, at one point, and that we're not going to expand one inch, and all of a sudden we're practically starting World War III because of Ukraine. What's Ukraine got to do with that?
Well, it was part of the plan to expand NATO right up to Russian borders, sure. Mm. And it moved inevitably, starting with Clinton. Then in 2008, Bush Jr. said that he wanted to incorporate Georgia and Ukraine into NATO. Bush Jr. encouraged the Saakashvili government in Georgia to attack Russian peacekeepers in South Ossetia, setting off the war there. And undeterred, then they continued with this policy with Ukraine, finally culminating in the 2004 coup against the democratically elected government of Ukraine and installing the regime we see there today.
So if we were, if we had a map in front of us right now, where we don't, but you could almost put a map together in our heads as we look at it. Everybody has a map of Europe in their heads. Everybody knows pretty much where Russia is. If you draw essentially and you start coloring in, Professor, everything from Germany toward Russia, you start to see that suddenly Estonia, Latvia, Poland, all these countries in that area right there suddenly start getting filled in as NATO colors all the way up to the border. The only thing that's really missing is that little piece in the bottom, and that's Ukraine, right?
That's correct. And you have to understand that, you know, Brzezinski, Zbigniew Brzezinski had this all in his book, The Grand Chessboard, that Ukraine was the key here for going after Russia, right? Without Ukraine, his opinion was, Russia was nothing. So we're seeing the continuation of these policies here
today. That's amazing. And that's funny because, I mean, you have some intellectual antecedents that relate back to Brzezinski as well as even Henry Kissinger. I mean, that's how formidable, how experienced you are. You've watched this happen. So that 2014 attempted coup, or I should say coup, fomented by the United States, do you think, I can't put you in Mr. Putin's head, but do you think that's what took him and the Russian leadership over the brink, where they said, okay, this is just a bridge too far? In that moment, that's where they started thinking, we've got to block this from happening. We're not going to let Ukraine be taken away.
Well, let me say this. During this entire crisis from the coup until today, I think Putin has acted as best he can, cool, collected. You'll note he did agree after the coup to go along with the Minsk agreements, which, if you read the Minsk agreements, provided that Donbass, those two provinces, Donetsk and Lugansk, would remain part of Ukraine, but with a federal structure of government along the lines that we have here in the United States of America. But it is clear that President Hollande, German Chancellor, herself, others have admitted that Minsk was just a stall job on President Putin. It was not reasonable good faith negotiations. And in the meantime, they would arm Ukraine to the teeth, the NATO states, which they did. But Putin did go along with the Minsk Accords, and it was the American NATO states that basically deceived him.
What do you say to those who work, as I would say, I don't know if you heard my conversation with Manila a little while ago, but I think to a certain extent, a lot of the people in the news media in the United States today just parrot whatever they're told to say by the State Department. But one of these arguments that's parroted is that the United States must do this, NATO must do this in Ukraine, because if not, Russia, Putin in particular, wants to go back in and take over Europe and take the rest of Ukraine, and that he's just this unbelievably crazy, frothing at the mouth expansionist. What do you say to that argument?
It's total scaremongering. I don't think anyone who has studied the history of either the Soviet Union or Russia seriously as an objective matter would go along with that. Yes, you're right. I went through the same PhD program at Harvard that produced Brzezinski before me, and I did offer both Soviet politics and Russian history on my PhD oral general examinations at Harvard that qualified me to teach those two subjects to Harvard undergraduates. Mm. That's not my reading of the record. Putin was provoked here. Indeed, before the, his special military operation, as he calls it, of Ukraine, he did offer two treaties, one to NATO and one to the United States to try to settle this matter. I read those treaties. They're very reasonable, negotiable treaties. Indeed, at the time, Foreign Minister Lavrov publicly stated that what we really want here is a commitment that Ukraine will not join NATO and will remain a neutral state. That's really what we wanted. And I regret to report the Biden administration absolutely refused to negotiate in good faith with the Russian government over these two treaties. Yeah. So here we are today.
Yeah, and I think that's a fascinating point. Let me switch gears with you for just a bit, because I know you're also writing an awful lot and commenting an awful lot on what's going on right now in Gaza. Over the weekend, it appears that two of the big war cabinet guys there, including Gantz, Benny Gantz, in Israel, have apparently either walked away or they're quitting or they're, I'm not sure what they're doing, but this tussle between Bibi Netanyahu apparently and his war cabinet has been increasing for some time now. What do you think is going on in this dynamic, and what might be its effect?
Well, the effect, I think, will mean that Netanyahu will be completely dependent on these extremist hardliner Jewish fundamentalists in his war cabinet, like Ben-Zvir and Smotrich. That's it. He has to rely upon them to stay in power. So things might get worse. I don't really see them getting better. As for Gantz, I think he's positioning himself for the next elections over there as an alternative to Netanyahu.
So you're saying that, I mean, how can they get, you just said you think things can get worse as a result of what happened over the weekend. My goodness, for the sake of the Palestinians, how much worse can it get?
You are correct, Rick. It could get a lot worse. We have 36,000 dead at a minimum, 10,000 dead under the rubble. I advised the Tamils on their peace process, and a new government came to power, tore up the draft peace negotiations agreement that we were working on, and starting in January of 2009 to May of 2009, they exterminated 146,000 Tamils. So I regret to say things could get a lot worse here.
Yeah.
What we're seeing the, if you take a look at it, the Biden administration is completely on board with what Netanyahu is doing here. I haven't seen him exercise any restraint. But there it is.
Yeah, a lot of people are saying that they're glad to see these guys go. That's interesting. You, with your experience, are saying this is not something that will probably bode well. Final question on this, Iran. What is the specter, given what's going on now with the fighting on the northern front with Hezbollah, that Iran will pick up the pace, so to speak, and that we could be seeing a real conflagration between these two countries?
It's extremely dangerous what's going there on the northern border of Israel. If Israel launches what even today is reported in the New York Times, a call for a preemptive attack attack on Lebanon.
Mm-hmm.
It could be disastrous, not just for the people of Lebanon, but also the people of Israel. Personally, I think Hezbollah has a lot of independent agency here. They are not a pawn for Iran, nor is Hamas. They make their decisions on their own. But of course, they do get support from outside, just as Israel gets massive support from the United States government from the outside.
Wow. Francis Anthony Boyle, experience and certainly a man who's intellectually curious and has the writings and the connections to understand the geopolitics of our world right now. And what a pleasure it's been to have you take us through it in ways that make it easy for us to be able to understand and then maybe just kind of get on our knees before we go to bed at night and pray that this thing can work itself out. Professor, right. You're a delight. Thank you, sir, for taking us through this. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Rick. Thanks.
Look forward to having you back. That's our show. Remember, always look outside your own box when it comes to truths, because we don't believe truths live in little boxes that only you can maybe relate to in a parallel world. Truths are everywhere. So that's what we believe. I'm Rick Sanchez. We'll be looking for you next time.